Do you remember his first year?
Yeah.
He averaged 30. His second year, he averaged like 28 a game. His career averages in college is 29 points on 47% shooting, 37% from three-point range. This brother and that crossover, we hadn't seen anything like that, you know, outside of Tim Hardaway. I mean, Chris Jackson was lethal.
Mahmoud for three. This one's good.
Really shooting a great percentage. Both teams off from the three-point line in this quarter.
McDice from Rose. Wide open left corner. Ellis now to Mahmoud for three. Four for four for downtown for Mahmoud now.
They're really looking for the open man. This Nugget team is playing very unselfishly, catching the Utah Jazz.
A Malone pick. Stockton pulls up from 10. Blocked by McDice, and the rookie's got the ball. Whips Yala to Ellis. Mahmoud again. Up at the top for three. Yes! He's 5 out of 5 in this first period of play.
Unbelievable. He is really on fire.
Ladies and gentlemen, awesome. This young man is, we can't call him the human highlight film because that's already taken. But as I was doing my research, Mike, trying to get something to justify this brother's ability, I mean, we could do the whole show on his highlight reel. But right now, it's my pleasure to bring in NBA legend Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. Welcome to the African American Show, Mahmoud. You're on the way.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
All right.
Well, my first question, Mahmoud, would be, what was the genesis of you making the name change? We had a lot of people back in the 60s made the name change. You had Kareem, you had Ali, you had Ahmad Rashad a little later. So you had a lot of guys that were doing that in the 60s. It was like a big thing. But you do it in the 90s. So what was the motivation? And then what does your name mean?
Well, first, the name Mahmoud means elegant and praiseworthy. Abdul-Rauf is the servant of the Most Kind. And for me, once I became a Muslim, it's not obligatory, but it's highly recommended. There's a verse where Allah says, when you enter the fold of Islam, enter wholeheartedly. So I wanted to abandon my old name, and I wanted to start off anew and start off fresh. And, of course, you know, names have significance. And kind of like discarding the old me and bringing in a new me. And this is the purpose behind why I changed it.
All right.
You know, I had the pleasure to hear Mahmoud in Detroit about a week or so ago. This guy is just a speaker, and he electrified the crowd. He electrified me. I mean, and talking about his life story and the work that you put in, Mahmoud, just to become an outstanding basketball player, but not only that, the work you put in to become strong academically. Could you speak to that?
Well, I'm still striving to be great at what I do. I don't know if I've actually reached that point, but they say anything worth having is worth working for. You know, there's a saying that geniuses are created in times of crisis. So I'm constantly trying to put myself in those positions to challenge myself, as I did when I was coming up trying to go to the NBA, always trying to think outside the box, play tougher opponents, because I knew that's what was going to make me better. Always trying to make the environment that I played in tougher than what the game was going to be in. So I'm trying to carry that over in this other phase of my life as well. So, but definitely it takes a lot of work, and I hope that I'm doing the right thing. I believe I am. So we'll see how it goes.
So, Mahmoud, let's go back to your freshman year. You came to LSU. Now, at the time, I was a student at Tennessee State, and as I said to Ricky earlier, I was born in Mississippi, but grew up up north, though. I was born in the Oxford area, but grew up north. So when you came out, you just shocked everybody with your game. Quick crossover, as they said on the highlights, comparing you to Tim Hardaway, who's from Chicago. So your gang had more of a northern and eastern look. So how did that come to be, you coming out of Mississippi? Because let's face it, nobody really saw flashy players like that come out of Mississippi.
Yeah, you know, but Mississippi got ballers. They just wasn't looking down there.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of people,
okay,
man, that can put it up, one thing, and they can put it on the floor. I mean, I just, man, I studied the game a lot, but also I thought outside the box. As, you know, 9 and 10 years old, I used to imagine myself playing against 2-3 invisible people. Wherever I went, they were always close to the basketball, like with their fingertips on it. So I was always trying to escape my imagination, create space with that, because I felt that no human being can stay with me like my imagination can. You know what,
okay,
I mean? So, and just,
yeah,
always trying to, you know, we all have patterns, and not trying to set into just one pattern, one way of doing things. And I thought this way when I was younger, and going beyond just making shots, you know, it's how you make the shots. You know, all the different type of angles and placement points, and that's just the way that's just the way my mind was at a young age, and literally I just and again, I studied the game. I watched the NBA more than I watched college basketball, and I would look at people play, and I would take photo images of what I saw, and I would go out and try to duplicate it. Then I'd try to tweak it, and I'd try to make it my own, because you can't really reinvent the game. Crossover is a crossover.
Right.
You know, behind the back is behind the back, but you can leave a legacy to where when they think of the crossover, when they think of your shot, they think of you. You know, so and that was my purpose when I was training.
All right.
Hey, man, when you were at LSU, you were down there with Shaq. I believe Stanley Rivers were down there. You guys were like a roach of selling out arenas everywhere you go. And I think about it, Mahmood, because you were telling me the other day that, you know, when you decided to turn pro, I think you had gone home and the sink in the bathroom had broken, and you was like, this is it, I'm going. But do you think some of these kids who are selling out arenas like you did back then should be rewarded or receive some type of stipend today in the NCAA?
There's no question whatsoever. I believe that wholeheartedly. They're making millions upon millions of dollars, and I don't think the payoff is anywhere close. You know, they promise you the possibility of an education with the possibility of getting a new job, but job markets have become so saturated, and they're exporting these jobs out the country, and it's not what it used to be when it comes to them. There are so many people with degrees and can't even get jobs in the degrees that they have. So, you know, I definitely think they should be compensated. I mean, a lot of people thought I took a pay cut when I left to go to the NBA. I did not get paid whatsoever. And I don't have problems speaking my conscience and saying what the truth is. Literally, there were nights when I literally had to find ways to get me a burger from Rally, a couple of burgers. And I got just fed up with it. I'm looking at this whole thing, and I'm like, man, and I go home, and I see my mother's refrigerator empty. And then I put my hand on the sink, and I said, forget this, man. I mean, I'm eating 3 meals a day, and here it is, my mother, you know, she don't even have food in her refrigerator. I said, I can't keep doing this. I got to go. And really, that's what pushed me over the edge of leaving. And I can only imagine how many other athletes possibly, you know, maybe experiencing something similar. I mean, people are getting paid, no question. I was just that one that wasn't. I was trying to do it the right way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Wow.
My question also is this. You know, you were dealing with an ailment with the Tourette syndrome.
Yes,
how
sir.
Did you manage to play ball and have that going on? What type of challenge was that? And what could you tell the audience about how you dealt with something like that? A lot of people just say, you know what, I'm not even playing sports. I don't want to deal with this because it's embarrassing or something like that.
Well, man, I prayed a lot. I'm going to tell you that right now. I prayed a lot. But, okay, but at the same time, too, you know, I just grew up with this attitude that, you know, if God wills, I'm not going to let this thing beat me. And also, with the understanding that we all have strengths and weaknesses. And I think that God gives us strength to overcome the weaknesses. And I don't think he's going to give me something I can't bear. So I began to look at this thing like, you know what, You know, as they say, geniuses are created in times of crisis. Blows that don't break your back strengthen it. You know, so I'm like, you know, I've been given this thing for a reason, and it's supposed to make me, it's supposed to build my character. It's supposed to make me stronger. So let's see. And really, when I start looking at it that way, there's a book out by Malcolm Gladwell talking about David and Goliath, how we see perceive advantages and disadvantages, and how oftentimes having something like this pushed you beyond where you yourself wouldn't have gone without it. And I began to see how, man, this is hard. It takes longer to do things, but boy, when I finally get it, it's like almost perfection. So I started looking at it that way, seeing the positives in it, and that's the way I dealt with it. It's easy for us to look at the negatives, and there was a period in my life when I, you know, especially when you're younger, why me? Why me?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the janking. You know, people ridiculing you and all of that. But after a while, you start saying, you know what, man, there's some positives in this thing that a lot of people don't see.
Yeah.
I mean, because
even
in the game of basketball, you know, the fact that you're out there playing and you for about an hour and a half and you're ready to go home, but Tourette steps in the pitch and say, listen, you got to make 10. Why are you tired? And all of them have to go all net. And you can't leave until you do it. I'm going to make your life miserable. So you got to fight through that in order to be able to go home and feel normal. And you could be on your ninth shot, all of them net. Your 10th one skims the rim. It goes in. You can't shoot the 10th one over again. You got to go back to zero. And the move that you make prior to shooting that shot, it could have no glitches in it. So that's perfect. That's seeking perfection. That's pushing you. You know what I mean? So you're doing this day in and day out. You know, you can't help but get better.
Wow.
We're talking with NBA legend Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf here on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show. We're going to be joined later in the show by Sam Puryear, the Big Ten Coach of the Year for golf at Michigan State University, one of the premier golf coaches in America. And this brother is serious, and he's going to give us some insight on the Masters. Hey, Mahmoud, drafted by the Nuggets, number 3 overall. I mean, you're playing well, and then this whole thing with the flag comes up. I mean, I got video of you taking down MJ when they won 72 games. I mean, you are building yourself up to be the cornerstone of that franchise until you decided you had an issue with the flag. Can you take us through that period?
Well, actually, it's not necessarily the flag itself. I just got an issue with injustice. But yet the flag is a symbol, as I said, of representing that injustice. It's not representing what they say it should represent. But for me, I just began to read more. And through my reading, I began to come across a lot of authors that I'd never heard before, the Noam Chomsky's, Gore Vidal, Randall Robinson's, Kwanzaa Kwangjuko's, Amos N. Wilson. And I'm reading stuff, man, that I'd never heard before about miseducation, you know, about imperialism, you know, globally, domestically. And I'm like, man, you know, and the Prince of Slaves. And so I started to feel like, you know, I've been cheated, that I've been lied to, and it made me angry. And I know I didn't want to live my life. You know, growing up, you see things and you know that it's wrong, but you don't feel confident enough to speak out about it. There's a sense of fear that I had. And I said, you know what, I don't want to live that way. You know, and I remember Frederick Douglass saying that knowledge doesn't befit a man to be a slave. You know, once you know something, once your mind expands, it can't go back to its normal size. And I'm like, man, I'm not looking to go back. I want to go forward, and it's going to be what it's going to be. And so I had to begin to take steps toward, you know, because I don't believe no one can be neutral. You know, you got to take a position. And for me, I want to be always on the side of justice, as much even if it means that, you know, my career is going to be affected in the process or my life. I have problems with. I don't want to leave this world, man, and know that I was a coward. Know that I saw things and should have stood up for something and I didn't stand up for it. and that's serious for me, and it's taking time to get there, and I don't plan on going backwards with that. But this is kind of like how it all, I mean, real briefly, trying to pack it all in the time that we have, how it all transpired.
Well, speaking of that, Mahmoud, so this happened like in the mid-90s. So then a little later in the new century, we get 9/11. Then, of course, now there's a huge attack on Muslims. So how did that affect you that now some people are looking at Muslims a whole lot differently because of 9/11? And then even if you're an American Muslim, it's still like, hey, well, you know, you might be a terrorist. So how did that affect you when 9/11 happened?
Well, those things were happening then, too. You know, they had movies coming out about the siege, you know, about Muslims in concentration camps in New York. You know, you had the wars in Chechnya. You had the Gulf War. You had a lot of things going on. So we had become what the communists were back in their era, the new enemy, right? Because America always has to have an enemy to attack, to justify its wars, to justify its aggression. So this was happening in the 80s and 90s coming up. Obviously, 9/11 amplified it even more, right? But it didn't. 9/11 for me didn't change the way I thought America, and when I say America, I'm talking about the system itself, viewed Muslims and was treating Muslims. It just brought it more to the forefront, and you know that's another story in itself. The whole is with that's within the 9/11 story. Yeah.
Sure. Wow. And the whole thing after this went down, I know you had your conversation with your coach at that time, Bernie Bickerstaff, but Mahmoud, it was like the whole country was coming down on you. Of course, you had. I don't know if you know this or not, but you had a lot of people that were in your corner. But with the way the media was and is in a lot of places, I don't know if you were able to feel that, but I'm sure you heard the wrath of those who were against you. How did you work through all that, man?
Man, you know, my faith in God, man, and at the same time knowing I'm comfortable with the information that I have. And I was certain that I was making the right decision. So that's enough for me. It doesn't matter necessarily what people are saying. I mean, I got death threats. I got the hate mail. I got to go back to Africa. But also, as you said too, I had a lot of support, a lot of mail that came in from atheists and Christians from all different denominations, Jews. Saying, look, we're for you. We believe the same thing. But, of course, at that time it was different because the media controlled more of the narrative. I'm sure that they got some of those same letters, but they can decide, hey, to show it or not. But it's a different now because of social media. It's like when Abdullah, the football player, the Muslim, went down in prostration, the NFL immediately wanted to fine him and suspend him. But then people got on social media and said, well, what about Tebow? And they had to pull back. See, we didn't have the media controlled it more then, and even what's his name, Harry Edwards,
Colin?
Profound brother.
Oh.
Yeah, we sat down and talked, and he said something that was profound. I never thought about it. He said, Mahmoud, he said when in the '60s, you know, John Carlos and Tommy Lee, they did what they did at the Olympics, and Kareem didn't go. He said that could be framed under a movement. Right, the Black Power movement. He said when Kaepernick did what he did, it was framed under a movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. He said, and these are his words. He said when you and Craig Hodges did what you did, there was no movement. Right? So they framed it the way they want to frame it. He said, so it's like you guys were in the ocean by yourself, right? And it made it harder. And again, and I'm not one to say what's harder or not harder, but his thing, I said, man, that's deep. I never thought about it. He said, because there was no movement to frame it under, so they could frame it how they wanted to frame it. I said, wow. You know, so it happens like that. I'm often asked sometimes, hey, man, when you did it, it was hard. I say, well, hold on. We can always go back. They can say, yeah, yeah, Mahmoud, when you did it, it was harder when Kaepernick did it. They said, yeah, but they could say, yeah, Mahmoud, but it was harder when Muhammad Ali did it. Then Muhammad Ali, it was harder when Paul Robeson did it. And Paul Robeson, it was harder than when Nat Turner did it. I mean, okay, the fact is somebody's doing it, and we're grateful for those people who inspired us to at least stand up for something and try to make a difference. And that's all we're trying to do.
All right, okay.
Well, let me just add this, and I will get Mike, and we won't keep my much longer. I know you're very busy, man, and we appreciate you. But you know, your legacy now, how does it feel when people mention names like Ali and Carlos and Robeson and Abdul Raouf? I mean, that's how you're regarded, the respect your stance has earned you from so many people. How does that feel?
Man, it makes me feel uncomfortable because, those guys, man, were on a whole nother level. You know, the Muhammad Ali, the Paul Robesons, man. But just to even be in the smallest of weight, you know, and I really, like an atom compared to what they've done, man, it's just that people recognize at least that your efforts, your sincere efforts of trying to make a difference, no matter how small it is, it's refreshing, and it definitely helps to continue to strive. So I'm very grateful and humbled by it, but at the same time uncomfortable because I'm not even close to what those guys have measured up to. But we're trying to elevate ourselves every day to get better.
All right, well, Mahmoud, you I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable, but you just turned 49, so you're right at the plateau. You're about to hit 50, and you got Kaepernick. you got the young Kaepernick, you know, probably seeking advice from you. But you know, he also has an issue where he wasn't dealing with the religious aspect as you were, but then again, his girlfriend now is being thrown into that. So when you guys had your conversations, what could you tell us that you guys talked about, and how did you kind of advise him about how he should navigate his way through this?
Well, one, we just shared each other's experiences. I especially when it pertains to athletes, and especially when they're black, I shy away from advice. The reason being, there's this tendency when we do stuff, especially if you're a black athlete, either you stumbled on it, you didn't put much thought into it, you don't really know what you're doing, or somebody had to tell you what to do. Like, you don't have a mind of your own. So when we met, it was literally, we had mutual friends in the room, and we were all just talking about issues. And he was sharing his ideas, and I was sharing mine. And if it resonated, you know, you roll with it. If it doesn't, you put it to the side and you keep moving. But no one gave advice. But one thing he did say that resonated with me, he said, this is the most free that he's ever felt in his life. And that's what the truth does to you. You know, I mean, they say Jesus said the truth shall set you free, right?
Right.
And like I said before, you know, Frederick Douglass said knowledge doesn't befit a man to be a slave, which is what? The opposite of freedom. And
right.
It shows. And this is what people sometimes don't understand. They say, well, how can he do that and jeopardize, you know, his career and his wealth? Because they're not on that level. See, the truth means more to him and people who take those positions. That means more to him and those people than anything. You know.
Mm. Wow.
And
wow.
A person is not going to compromise their integrity and that truth for a paycheck. And so many people have done and are doing. And so that's how, at one time in Africa, they say books was the number one commodity over natural resources because people understood the value of information, right? They understood what information can produce. So he's one of those figures that sees, like, hey, man, hold on, man. This is where it's at. You know,
Wow, brother. Mahmoud, could you stay a couple extra minutes with us and maybe take one or two calls from our listeners? You told me when you went to LSU that your reading comprehension skills were extremely poor. You said your high school education had failed you.
Yeah.
But you were able to lift yourself up to become a very learned brother. Could you speak to that part of your life?
I was put in a special ed class when I was in the seventh grade, and I didn't think I belonged. Because having Tourette's syndrome, you really it takes you a long time to do things and to get things done. And in certain situations, you know, your mind just jams up, you know, and you need to be in a different environment. And so they put me in that class. I was fortunate to have a teacher that said, look, within 2 months or so, if you can get out, we'll let you out. And I buckled down, and he said, listen, you don't belong. I said, that's what I was trying to tell you. When I went to LSU, they put me in they were trying to assess where I needed to be as a student. They had me reading something and had me trying to define words that I could read words and I could spell well, but my comprehension skills were terrible. So, I mean, I couldn't define, I could spell words that I didn't even know what they meant. I couldn't define words. They asked me to recall the story. I couldn't really recall the story. They asked me to, you know, put things in. I couldn't put it in context. So they had to put me in a remedial reading class. So I had to go through the process of learning how to read, recall the story, pick out the moral of the story, define words, and it was humiliating. You know, and a lot of people didn't know that I was even in this class. You know, you're looking at this athlete scoring all these points on the cover of magazines, but looking at himself as being inadequate, low self-esteem, I suffered academically, but a lot of the things that I memorized my way through school. I never really learned anything, and it wasn't until I read the book. It wasn't until I read the book, The Prince of Slade, that it pissed me off, because I'm thinking about here's a guy that, you know, his father was the king of Timbuktu. His son was captured and brought to Natchez, Mississippi, which was only 2.5 hours away from me, and you couldn't teach me that. You couldn't tell me this, because this was the time when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s when we would hear, if you white, you all right. If you yellow, you a good fella. If you brown, get down. If you black, get back. Watching films like Sanford and Son. You know, watching films like Sanford and Son, mostly every time it seemed like they're getting ready to get out the junkyard, they get kicked back in. Good times. Every time it seemed like they're getting ready to get out the project, something put them back in. So, it you know, your environment is telling you that, hey, Most of y'all, few of y'all might make it out the cracks, but most of y'all are gonna end up like Sanford, like Lamont and Fred and James and JJ. Y'all gonna be right back here. So this is why I could never really embrace success and feel that I was worthy growing up, because all the images and the stories that society was telling me about how I should look at myself and view myself. You know, and this is why I say it fair, because if I'd have known about that then and about Timbuktu having universities. You know, being a modern society and technologically advanced compared to, you know, how Africa and blacks were being perceived, that I would have probably not thought that way about myself growing up.
Wow. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah. Samuel, I got a text question for you. Do you have a favorite playing moment?
Oh, wow. Oh, man, those are always the toughest for me when they say favorite, because it's like I got to choose. There are many moments, playing moments that I had. You talking about in terms of basketball, I was on?
Yes, yes.
Oh, man. Oh, my goodness. There are plenty. I mean, from high school all the way up.
How about the game against Ole Miss with Gerald Green?
Man, you know what? That's funny, because at halftime, Gerald had 30-something, and I think I had 19. And then second half, I flipped it where I had 30-something, and I think he ended up with 53, and I ended up with 55. I don't know if he knew what he had, because I don't count. I just play. And right. I'm like, wow. I mean, that's a classic. That's a classic
right.
game. But I look back at my career, and I say, wow, you hear guys scoring 70 points and 80 points. I look back and I say, you know what, I was never that type of player. All the games I had high-scoring points, we needed it.
Right.
It's not like we were playing a team that wasn't a good team, and I'm going to see if I can go get 80. we never played that way. And yeah. but that was a classic. The Florida game was I didn't know I had 53.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was in a zone, and then after it was over, they were saying I fouled out three of their point guards. I'm like, wow. You know, so and then capping it off with the alley-oop play that we had in
right.
Florida, and they were the number one team in the SEC at the time. That, I mean, that's
yep.
a huge highlight because that's, I think, my fifth game of my freshman year. The third game, Dale pulls me to the side after the second game, scoring 21. He said, we need you to score more. I ended up with 48, and that's when it began to get a little – tricky for me, man. I'm like, wow, I'm doing the same stuff I've been doing since elementary school. Like the same moves I've been working on day in and day out, being consistent with. And I'm thinking I'm going to have to change my game drastically. I'm doing the same stuff and it's working.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you know, researching you today, I think you put 51 up on John Stockton. You broke the mighty Bulls team that won 72 games. You guys beat them in Denver. I think you had 32, 33 that day. Michael was chasing you all over the place. That's not even in your rankings anywhere.
Well, I mean, it's nice to have broke their streak, but I tell people all the time, man, I say I would have loved to be on their side of it, winning the championship.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, yeah. Jordan, they at that time, they were trying to play Jordan from what I heard, point guard, and he had just got off a road trip, I think. Stoudemire had lit him up, and then somebody else had lit him up, so he was coming to them, and I'm like, man, I don't want to be the oddball. You know, it's like me guarding Jordan. If I had to guard Jordan on the post all night, he'd be 6'6" with all of that
right.
weight. Over time,
right.
that weight is going to wear me down, no matter how strong I am, how conditioned I am. So he's playing out there. He has to get used to coming off, watching where the pick and roll is going to come from. And then you have guards that, listen, most of us are going to be quicker than him. Our footwork is going to be quicker. Getting to spots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it was a different position, you know, for them to, I mean, it's good. I mean, you know, it shows his heart that he took the challenge, but it's like me trying to play him in his position the whole game. It's going
right.
to be a long
yeah.
night because,
okay.
look, man, this is our world. You're talking about from one end to the next and coming down and changing direction. Now you got to watch where the pick is coming. You got to fight over the pick. You don't really do that a lot on that wing. The way you're gonna do it with the point guard, so it was just a different setup for him. Yeah.
Hey,
and I was
listening
just having
to the
falling because I didn't want to be the oddball.
You're listening to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show with your host Ricky Hampton, Michael Robinson. We're joined by NBA legend Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. Mahmoud, I promise I'm gonna get you out of here, man. And we're gonna be joined by another legend from the world of golf. Sam Perrier, the former Big Ten Coach of the Year at Michigan State University, won a national championship at Stanford University. And all these young cats think that golf for black people started with Tiger Woods, but we have a long tradition in the world of golf. And Sam is coming up. Mike Blue, could you take a couple of calls? We got so many people that want to, I'm sure, say hello and thank you and just show their appreciation to you.
Yes, sir, that's fine.
Eric code 717. You're on with my move.
Good evening. Peace and blessings.
Good evening,
bro. Especially peace and blessings to you all, especially to you, Mahmoud. Mahmoud, could you tell the audience and people listening, at what year, what point did you come into the light that you was just like, this is just too much? Could you recall like a specific incident that you said that, you know what, I've had enough of all what I've seen and I want to make that change?
Well, I'll say this before answering that. It started when Dale Brown at LSU gave me the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
And when I began to read his life, man, and just how he articulated things and how sincere he seemed to be and how courageous he seemed to be, that was something that I didn't have. And that was something that I wanted to be a part of my character. So the point for me was when I decided to become a Muslim and I began to read. And I can't give you the exact date, but I became a Muslim after my first year in the NBA. And the first book that I finished was the Quran. And then it gave me a sense of pride that I actually finished the book. So there was a bookstore on Colfax called Salam Books by a brother out of Philly named Bashir. And he had, like, political books, conspiracy theorist books, history books. And, man, at that time, I just developed a curiosity for everything. I wanted to know everything. And then I was constantly talking to brothers on road trips wherever I went. They were sharing their insight on different political and social issues, religious issues. And the more I'm reading, the more I'm seeing these things, that's really what began to spark this in me. Like, you know what, man, there's a saying that don't be like a donkey with books on your back. You got all this knowledge and you're not putting it to use. You got a responsibility. You know, and I said, you know, I got to do something with this, man. It's not enough just to carry this in my head. So I began to share it. And you realize that a lot of people think like you. The difference is not a lot of us make it public. And then it goes from one thing, like, you know what, man, I got to make a stand. You know, I don't care how, you know, everybody Roy said something. Once you see something, you can't unsee it. To be silent, to say nothing, is just as political an act as speaking out. Either way, you're accountable. So I'm like, well, shoot, if by being silent, I see something and I'm silent about it, I'm just as accountable as speaking out. I might as well go for broke. Let it all hang out. And so those are the things that began to change my position. And just not wanting to, really, man, just wanting to, I made a commitment to myself. And I said, you know what, I'm not always going to be eloquent and articulate. That's my goal. But I want to always be as much as humanly possible sincere. And I said, and my commitment was to myself. I said, I want to live and die with a free conscience and a free soul, whether people like it or not. And that's what I'm aiming for before I leave this earth.
Wow.
Amen.
That's awesome, bro. That's awesome. Hey, we got a text question, Mahmoud. You were Steph Curry before Steph Curry, and how would you fare in the NBA today with the, you know, they can't put their hands on you anymore?
Yeah, you know, that's tough. I mean, a lot of it is that's a part of it, but it's also getting on a team. You know, that the timing, the team that you're on, that value your skill level and where you are and allow you that, you know, not fighting to like a Nat Turner to get your freedom, but just say, hey, man, let this guy play. Take the handcuffs off of him. And that type of situation, man, if the shots are falling, it literally becomes like target practice with people like Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, because once you face them up, the rules are you can't put a hands on them. Now, their back is to you, their side is to you. You can kind of touch them a little bit. But once they face you up, man, especially if you're quick and you can pull your shot from different angles, it's a different – anytime you involve resistance to anything, it's going to make it tough. Anytime you don't have resistance, it's going to make it easier. So if you can already play, you got speed, the game is going to be easier for you. And that's the best way for me to answer. Now, to say what I would do, God knows best, man. You know, we have our days.
Let's go. Area code 504. You're on with, I'm sorry, 5540. You're on with Mahmoud Abdul-Raouf. Area code 504-540-3866. No, I'm sorry. It's 540.
504 is New Orleans, right?
Hey, you hear me?
Yeah, I know that's New Orleans. Yeah, this is 540.
Is somebody talking?
That's Virginia. Go ahead, Mike.
All right, well, my question.
Because
well,
we got to get my
move
out of here.
Yeah, well, my thing here is my movie. So, you know, we talk about a lot of the millennials who didn't really see your game and they heard, you know, of you be a legend, but they got a chance to see you in the 3-on-3. So how important has it been for you to still be playing ball at that level and 3-on-3 and it's coming back again this year, and are you going to participate this year?
Very important, man. I mean, I'm loving it. I'm a competitor and I'm pretty much all I train religiously, and so to be out there, being able to still move, and people can see, glimpses of what you can do, and now the fact that they're getting younger, so I'm even more excited because I was joking with somebody the other day. I said if I outdo you, that makes you gonna look bad. Yeah, I'm 49 years old. I said if I'm close and I compete, you look bad because I'm 49 years old. If you end up beating me, they say, oh man, the man is 49 years old. so you have more to lose than me. but I'm loving it, man, because I love to compete. I train some of these guys. And from time to time, I get out there and I compete with them. And I don't have problem getting to my spots when I want to get to my spots and getting my shot off, mm-hmm. even at 49 years old. So to answer your question, also, it's a blessing, man. I'm appreciative of people like, you know, Ice Cube for putting this on. And I just hope that we're fair with him, that we do our due diligence, and, man, we get in shape because his name is on this thing. And I told this to him in his face, you know, that I hope that we do right by him as a group, that we go out and we make sure we take care of ourselves, man, to show the best of ourselves, because you got to think if my name was on it or somebody. So, you know, I appreciate him, and I want to show him I appreciate him by staying in shape and going out there and doing the best that I can do. In the process, man. So, and to answer your question, if God wills, I've signed up for next year. The first game is June 22nd in Houston. The same team. We're gonna have a few different players on the team, but it's looking interesting.
All right.
Hey, Mahmoud, I'm gonna let you take one more call, Mahmoud.
Yes, sir.
540, you're on.
How you doing, Mr. McMoon? My name is Robert T. Green. How you doing, Mr. Robinson, Ricky? I just want to make a quick point, and I want to thank you because as an athlete, what's not been mentioned is that, you know, you played in a team sport. And so a lot of guys, whether it's Muhammad Ali or guys before you, to make a stand on a team sport where you know that the majority of the players are taught how to and what to do and also to act in the same way, to be a leader on the field, on the court in your case, and off the court, but yet lead by example, is something that, you know, today's athletes in college and in pros cannot be measured. You know, obviously media doesn't give you the credit that you deserve for that, but to take that stand, not only as an athlete, but as a man in general, to stand aside when it comes to a team in uniforms, I want to appreciate that. I want to let you know I really appreciate it and what I try to do today for athletes, you know, young and old. So I thank you very much for that.
No, thank you for saying that.
Hey, Rob, while we got you on here.
Appreciate it.
Well, while you got Mahmoud on here, tell them about your company and what you're doing for young athletes today.
Okay, so my name is Robert T. Green. I'm the CEO of a company called Pre-Post Game. It stands for before, during, and after. And essentially, separate of that, I go by the name The Players Rep, meaning everything I do, the only thing that I do is work for the athletes and the family's best interest, teaching business principles of our sport, how it's short-lived and how things go, and even making proper decisions as early as high school. And what really goes into college and the education piece, transition succession plan, and know who you are outside of the game before the game is over. Because, like I said, pre-post game, you never know when it's going to end. And essentially, too, with 2018, sports, like my mantra is sports is not a game, it's all business. So what I do is some young athletes that come from areas like I come from, the hood or whatever, instead of taking away their dream, I'll say, you know what, for example, I'll ask a kid, what's your three favorite players? And they'll say LeBron, Kobe, they'll say Steph Curry. I say, okay, fine. Tell me what they're getting paid. So they'll tell me, and then they'll say, okay, well, I ask them, what's the tax code in that state? Then they start breaking that down. So I start teaching them about business principles, real money. So now they engage with it. So now they continue to follow their dream, but the reality is the numbers are slim already as it is. But whenever that game does change and go a certain way, they're already prepared in life to do what they got to do on and off the court. So, again, when people come up and talk to them and start feeding them dreams and things like that, we talk about education and power and protection. If those people are not communicating those tactics to you, you need to look the other way. Because at the end of the day, they are trying to make money or use you to get to where they want to be, but not where you want to go. So that's just a quick synopsis of what I do. So at the end of the day, you inspire what you do to what I try to do today for athletes at every age, before, during, and
man,
after. So I appreciate
man,
you.
Man, let me just say something, man. When you said, I think, education, power, protection, or I don't know all the words
yes.
you just used, but all the things that you just mentioned, man, is definitely is profound. It's needed. You're a valuable resource. I hope that – I wish that we would have had something like that, a person like yourself, man, disseminating that type of information at that early age, because it's very much needed. I pray for you nothing but success. I hope that a lot of these young people who are listening, man, will gravitate to what you said and even come out and allow you to mentor them, because, I mean, I listened to everything you just said, and it's some powerful stuff that you just dished out, man, and nothing but the best for you. If there's anything that I can do, even if it's just passing out pamphlets. I'm here just look, brother, I don't mince my words. Literally, I love everything you just said, man, and just continue to do what you're doing, and it's gonna show dividends.
I appreciate that. And your story again in itself leads by example and encouraged to me what I continue to do.
Well, thank you, brother.
You know what? I'll get Mahmoud and Rob, I'll get your information together. I'll get you two guys together. And be sure to check out Rob on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com Facebook page every Wednesday at 6 p.m. He is dishing information on the business of sports, and he is certainly a great friend of the show and a great asset for young and up-and-coming athletes. Mahmoud, my brother, we are going to let you go, man. It has been an honor. And let me just say I have all kind of texts saying – God bless Mahmoud for being the inspiration he needs to be. People thanking you from all over the country. And Mike and I certainly thank you very much for sharing your experience with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. And nothing but the best to all of you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
All right, thank you, Mahmoud.